Hughes.
Amir and the latest one he has with us. He's about to speak on it up at Barnes & Noble. There it is. Emerson and the Dream of America. There's a subtitle, Finding Our Way to a New and Exceptional Age. So there it is. And so really, Richard is one of our most knowledgeable people about Ralph Waldo Emerson. In fact, to me, listening to him last time, it got to me he's virtually embodying Emerson at this point. So it's really great that he could be with us today. But Richard started off as a scholar of antiquity and the classical world, and did his PhD in classics there. So he's also imbued with a knowledge of Neoplatonism and Plato and all the wonderful things in that classical world. So here I'll read a little intro for him. He's the author of 10 books, 4 of them on Ralph Waldo Emerson, others on ancient Greece. There's a traveler's key to ancient Greece. If you're going to ancient Greece, you want to take that with you to awaken you to the significance of the ancient sacred sites. He has spoken over the years a number of times at the Open Center, including last year, he also gave a keynote address for the reinstatement of the Delphic Games in Delphi. Wow. That's quite a thing, isn't it? Who knew there were Delphic Games? But to give the inaugural address for the reinstatement of the Delphic Games, I mean, that's pretty amazing.
In English.
Yeah. He's also lectured on Cyprus, which for some reason has been spelled here like the Cyprus tree, but of course it's spelled C-Y-P-R-U-S. And he has taught on the Greek mystery religions in the doctoral program at Pacifica Graduate Institute, one of the fine Californian alternative graduate institutes down there in Santa Barbara. His book, Emerson and the Dream of America, is coming out any day, and he'll be speaking directly on that up at Barnes & Noble's. And this morning he's going to speak to us about Neoplatonism, Emerson, how it all weaves together, and we're really fortunate to have him with us. I'm very appreciative of him coming down to do this, so let's give a warm welcome to him.
When Ralph and I first talked about this, he said that I would simply repeat, or at least embellish, comments that I made up at Menlo in June. And then this book came out, and I was able, or shall I say, my publisher was able to secure a reading and signing at Barnes & Noble at, you know, the big store at 82nd Street Broadway, which is hard to get, and I was very grateful to get it. And but it turns out that part of the contract for doing this is that I'm not supposed to talk about this book or Emerson in New York for a month prior to next Thursday. So please don't say anything to anybody. Or else I should be, I don't know. Something dire will happen to me. But if any of you are free next Thursday at 7 p.m. on Broadway and 82nd Street, please stop by, because August in New York emailed my various people that I knew in New York, and they are either at the shore, in the mountains, or in the desert, so, as you can imagine. I wanted, however, to talk. It's interesting, having had this talk about Philadelphia from Carl, because I wanted to talk a little bit about New York and Alexandria, and Emerson will be woven into this, I promise. But I do want to talk a little bit about the notion or the whole concept of the esoteric quest as it pertains to Alexandria, which is coming up next June. In order to give you a feel of it and talk a little bit about the amazing world of Alexandria in the first and second centuries AD, when Alexandria was at its peak of power and influence as the cultural center of the world at that time, it does contrast somewhat with New York City. My apologies to Philadelphia being the cultural center of the world at the moment. And I will demonstrate that briefly, but I don't know if any of you have seen the mysterious Fayum portraits. These are portraits done in encaustic, which is beeswax with pigment hooked into it, melted beeswax. These were portraits that were done in the first and second century in Fayum, Egypt, and they are the most, to me, the most astounding portraits you can imagine. And here are the images that were done in life and in wax, the sun being hot enough to melt the wax, and these portraits were done in life.
They put the wax on their face?
No, no, no. These are portraits done on wood.
Oh, wood.
With the individual sitting, doing a sitting.
Oh, yeah.
So they were painted
wax.
In life, by as a life in wax. On wood, and then eventually, when the person died, it was cut out and put on the coffin, the sarcophagus, and these were dug up. But it gives you a feeling for these people. It's extraordinary, these beautiful, beautiful people. This is, of course, the elite of Egypt at the time in the first and second century, when they would have been working and studying. These were done, of course, in life when the people were young, so by the time they died, if they were fortunate enough to live a long life, this is the image that went into the ground or into the tomb. Here is a priest of Serapis, one of the pagan gods that was central to the life of Alexandria. Anyway, if you'd like to look at this afterward, I'll leave it up here. The connection, at the time that we are speaking, Alexandria was a city of over a million people with extraordinary gifts, not only the great library and the great museum and cultural centers and so on, but it compares in an interesting way to New York. And I just happened to look this up, and I felt it was an interesting comparison. New York City is the most linguistically and religiously diverse city in the world. The 8.4 million inhabitants communicate in 800 different languages. 83% of New Yorkers are affiliated in some organized religion, which is the largest percentage anywhere in the United States of people responding to that fact. Christians comprise about 70% of the population, 40% Catholic, 30% Protestant. They attend approximately 2,000 churches and 4,000 other smaller gatherings. Of course, New York has the largest Gothic cathedral in the world, at St. John the Divine, and of course also in the center of the city, the powerful, politically powerful St. Patrick's Cathedral. we have 12% of New York claim Jewish descent. There are approximately 1,000 synagogues in the city, 70% permanent, 30% temporary places. There are 1 million Muslims living in the city. Some claim 1.4 million, and the figure is probably closer to 800,000. There are more than 100 mosques in the city, plus an unknown number, which is interesting in light of our recent conflicts. So Alexandria was very similar to this. Alexandria had theaters, of course, and we are perhaps the most densely populated theater population around. And the other great symbolism that I think is interesting has to do with the end of the of Alexandria as an important and culturally significant city, which was the death of Hypatia. How many of you are familiar with her story? Most people here. The movie Agora is out there. It's coming out in DVD in October. If you want to Netflix it. And I learned in the process of studying this that when Hypatia was killed by monks from the desert who were brought into the city by Saint Cyril, and she was dragged out of her chariot and her body scored with oyster shells and then burned, that Hypatia was killed in front of the three Cleopatra's needles that were there erected near her home. And those later, much later in history, Cleopatra's needles were sent, one to London, one to Paris, and one to New York, where it sits in Central Park behind the Museum of Natural History. So if you want a real connection to that moment in time, you can go into Central Park and place your hand on that obelisk, which, if it could talk, could describe that moment in 414 AD. So we have lots of connections. What got me started with Emerson 20 years ago was his interest and preoccupation with Neoplatonism and the Greeks. References to Heraclitus, to Anaxagoras, to Pythagoras were very common in his work, and in particular, of course, Plotinus, who was a great inspiration to him. Not only that, but he kept a copy of the Bhagavad Gita at his side at all times. And there is a very interesting and real connection between Vedanta and Neoplatonism, which I will talk about. So I'm going to go back, not historically, I don't have time for that, but I want to go back to 500 BC, to the axial moment, to the great moment in history when the great teachers were alive and teaching, the Buddha and Lao Tse, we think, Jeremiah in the desert, and Heraclitus and Thales and Anaxagoras among the Greeks, and the great teacher, and Confucius also in China. So the great teachers were alive and teaching at this, what has been referred to as the axial moment in history. And Heraclitus said at one point, listening not to me, but to the Logos, it is wise to agree that all things are one. And it was at that time a an effort by these natural philosophers to begin to pull together the mythology and history and the life that, that everyone was struggling with of survival to say there is a fundamental unity behind all creation and human experience. And that unity is reflected first in the teachings of Pythagoras, who was born on the island of Samos, which was right close to the what is now the Turkish coast and the city of Ephesus, where Heraclitus in 500 BC lived and taught. And later, of course, became one of the early Christian churches, as we've already heard this morning. So it was Pythagoras who began to think about and talk about the relationship of unity and geometry in particular, and number, and begins with this notion, which I hope you can see. This is one of my wife's. This is one of my wife's paintings, also in encaustic. My wife has been working in art with the Golden Mean for about 20 to 25 years, and she will be. You're going to hear this afternoon from Dorothea Rockbird, who has also been working with the Golden Mean. And my wife and Dorothea will be just showing together in a traveling museum show next year. Pythagoras began with a notion of geometry and number which is associated with reality itself, which is not something that we are accustomed to thinking about. We're accustomed to be following Euclid in geometry, which we were all exposed to in the 10th grade in high school. And the great Euclid, who taught, by the way, in Alexandria, went on to develop from Pythagoras in the exoteric world of geometry. But this is how it begins, and you'll see the associations that are made between number, geometry, and reality, or truth, from the way this evolves. We begin with the point, a single point here, which generates a circle. And that beginning point is the logos. And it also is the way in which the architects of ancient Greece began to design their temples. They first drew a circle upon the ground, in the case of the Parthenon, about 60 feet in diameter. And from a spiritual point of view, they drove a stake into the ground which fixed the spirit of the god to the place, so that he would remain there for their communion with him or her. And then they drew a circle. The circle is the absolute, it is the one, it is the ineffable. And then, from the one, duality appears. You perhaps have seen the wonderful diagram of the U with the I looking across at itself, the idea that from unity, duality appears automatically. It appears just as self-consciousness appears. So the second thing that we find is a line which is drawn by two concentric circles. And the line, however, is unstable. It moves. It doesn't have any stability whatsoever. And the third point, which happens automatically in creation, is the third point which creates a stable construct, the triangle, which is the also from Pythagorean doctrine, is the first plane, first two-dimensional plane. So you have, you can see how the triangle is created simply by drawing a line through these two concentric circles. But you'll notice how in the earliest geometry, the earliest architectural work, and of course in Greek we have the arche techne, arche meaning beginning, the first, and techne, creative work. Techne also refers to craft and manifestation. So the arche techne is the architect. After the triangle comes the square, and this also is in three dimensions, the cube, and the square is the first manifestation, is the first appearance of the manifest world. And following that, and I'm not going through to 10, but just the first five, is the pentagon. And the pentagon is the first spiritual number arising from this movement of creation. And it also, the pentagon also is what one needs to create the golden mean rectangle. And the golden mean rectangle becomes an extraordinarily sacred principle in geometry and manifestation, because it is the means by which we return to unity. In a conference that I gave with Robert Lawler, who did the wonderful workbook Sacred Geometry, he talked a good deal, Lawler talks a great deal about the spiritual significance of the golden mean because of the way it regenerates and returns to unity. Here is an image of the golden mean. That spiral that you see, we see in nature, all over the nature, not only in the brilliant intellectual work of the chambered nautilus, who sits down at the bottom of the sea and creates the golden mean without even thinking about it, but also in the spiral inside a sunflower, and in the way in which leaves grow, or plants grow, in what we discovered in the Renaissance was the Fibonacci series, the Fibonacci numbers, which relate to the creation of the golden mean. The idea is that from this point here, one can back up, if you will, and return to the one, return to unity. So that it is the design that allows us to do that. And architects through the ages have used the golden mean to express that notion. And we find, for example, much to our surprise, that the Great Pyramid is built on the principle of the golden mean, or at least it is argued that that is the case, which puts the golden mean back into, what, 3400 BC, or 2400. And so it's difficult to know where, in fact, the golden mean was first introduced and first expressed. So the esoteric nature of this process is expressed in this geometry. The way I've been speaking about the geometry is not the sort of thing one hears in school, because of course it doesn't help us to pass the regents, I don't know what, but it doesn't in fact come into the discussion. One of the issues that arise, people always ask the question, why the conflict with Christianity and Neoplatonism, why was there such tension? And of course, it's a long and difficult history. But primarily, the reason is that when the first Christian converts began to move down into Egypt and into Alexandria, Christianity was, for many people, a peasant religion. It was a religion that was available and had given access to everyone. Jesus, in his teachings, spoke to everyone, spoke to ordinary people. His disciples were fishermen. And this ran counter to the experience of Alexandria and the experience of learning in the ancient world, because the word esoteric in those days meant elite, meant that this was only for the educated, only for the knowledgeable. You needed Greek, you needed an understanding of sacred geometry, you needed all of this accoutrement of the intellect to begin to work effectively with this material. And one always wonders what was taught in these schools, and we'll get to that. But Christianity came in opposition to this in many respects. And it was finally the 3rd century AD when Christians, Clement of Alexandria, for example, developed an intellectual tradition around Christianity to try to move into that inner circle of the esoteric world of paganism, or what was thought of as paganism. But in fact, one of the things we have learned, hopefully, although religious conflict in this age that we're living in would begin to question that, but we hope we have learned a degree of understanding and tolerance of these quote-unquote differences to be able to move into what, as Heraclitus said, it is wise to agree that all things are one. And that and what to me was interesting about Heraclitus was the way he put that. He said, listening not to me, but to the Logos, it is wise to agree that all things are one. And a student might raise his hand and say, but we are listening to you. How does that work? Good question. Because esoterically, listening to the Logos is the way into this perception. So the question then becomes, how do we listen to the Logos instead of this, instead of another voice coming at you, which is no more full of insight than anyone listening, right? So Heraclitus, who was raised in a family, he could have been the head or leader of Ephesus, which was a major city, a major center, one of the 7 wonders of the world. The Temple of Artemis was in Ephesus with its 140 columns in the Ionic order. An extraordinary, the largest temple in the world, devoted to the Earth Mother, devoted to Gaia, or in this case, Artemis in her aspect as a nature goddess and Earth Mother. So Heraclitus said, no, I don't want anything to do with secular ruling. I don't want anything to do with this. I just want to teach and think. And he lived up in the hills. And the tradition is in Christianity, in fact, and which is very strong evidence of this in in Ephesus, and I remember the day when I was walking up to the sanctuary of St. John in Ephesus, and you walk onto this area in which is now a ruin, and suddenly you come upon this piece of marble in the ground, and it says the tomb of St. John, and there's no fence around it or anything. It's just there it is, and there is a tomb underneath which you can look into, empty naturally, but here it is, the tomb of St. John. And then if you go a little further outside of town, there is a fenced off area full of graves, and it is here, there's a little plaque saying the tomb of Mary Magdalene, and the very few Christian women who are still in Ephesus go out to that little fenced area, and with little pieces of cotton, they wrap a prayer around the fencing, and the whole fencing is full of them. And it is here that John and Mary and Mother Mary came to Ephesus when they fled Jerusalem, and the Virgin Mary lived and died in a small hut on the hill overlooking the Temple of Artemis. And a French nun had a vision of where that hut was, spoke to her bishop, and eventually it was Pope John Paul that sent a archaeological group over to Ephesus, and they examined the area, and John decided that yes, that was correct. That's where Mary was, that's where the hut was, and to this day there are two nuns that live there. And there's a little spring that comes out. It's a very lovely spot. And it is a typical site where people go. That's a footnote. What I'd like to address is the relation of the Neoplatonic school and talk about Ammonius Saccas, and Emerson does get into this, but Ammonius Saccas, who was the teacher of Plotinus, and Ammonius Saccas is also, according to Madame Blavatsky, the father of Theosophy, and was drawn from oblivion by the by Blavatsky and her movement, because they named him their leader or their progenitor. And it was Saccas who taught Plotinus. Saccas never wrote anything down, but for 11 years Plotinus was his student. And then Plotinus left to go to the East, got far enough to learn some of the fundamentals of Vedanta and the Eastern tradition before having to turn back and eventually settle in Rome. But the teaching of Plotinus is an extraordinary look into the details of the relationship between the East and the West. Let's see if this is going to work. Oh yes, okay. Now, this diagram on the left, I have my wife to thank for this extraordinary thing, what she has done in a wonderful book, which you can buy, and I wish you would. entitled, was published by Chris Bamford at Lindisfarne. It's entitled Bringing Consciousness Bliss, Satchitananda. And it is an extraordinary document that explains Vedanta in a number of ways. I have put against this diagram the fundamental teachings of Aquinas, and I'd like to spend a few moments talking about this relationship. The diagram that Astrid Fitzgerald, the way, the diagram that Astrid did, first of all, oh, Carl, may I borrow your little thing? That's very handy. Thank you. First of all, there is this large circle which represents the spiritual world, the world of spirit. At the top of that is Brahman, the ineffable, without characteristics, without personality. The absolute as well as in Plotinus is the one, as well as the one. From Brahman, the universe is created by the sound of Om, which emanates from Brahman's nature, from his essence, and from that the spiritual world is created. It is essentially described as Sat Chit Ananda, Sat meaning being. So being becomes then the first manifestation of Brahman's nature, and being has attributes, although not describable, but attributes nonetheless. And being then, there are these three forces, Sat, Chit, consciousness, and Ananda, bliss. And these three work together to create Atman and Purusha, and those are sometimes characterized as male and female, and from them, or it, or that, the manifest world appears. And the manifest world then becomes these lower circles. I think I can make this a little clearer. Ah, okay, sorry about that. It's not you, it's it. This lower circle contains three characteristics that emulate being, consciousness, bliss. And the three lower circles, buddhi, which can also be described as the attribute of discrimination. It is that which allows us to discriminate between ineffable emanations or ineffable input into our life. Chitta is memory, the storehouse of memory, both collectively as a people and individually, and then ahankara. I need my notes very quickly. Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Corresponds to bliss, or the experience of enlightenment, which rare individuals achieve through spiritual work. So this characteristic then comes down to where we live in the world of mind, senses, and body. Now, there is this line here represents this point of contact between the spiritual world and the physical world of manifestation, And that, in Plato and in Plotinus, is called the metaxy, which is a Greek word meaning gap or point of connection. And when the Greeks built a temple using sacred geometry, fixing that stake in the ground to hold Apollo to his temple in Delphi, at least for half a year, he went south in the winter. you can't blame him. And Delphi is, I remember sitting one New Year's Day in the theater in Delphi, and it had snowed overnight. I was sitting up in the top row of the theater, and as the sun came up, I could actually watch this 1 inch of snow melt, which was an amazing experience. And a Greek guard came out of a little guardhouse, and he had a glass of water in his hand, and he did this, facing east first, crossed himself, and then went around to the four points, and then went back into his guardhouse. And then the real world intruded as I watched the BMWs with the skis on top headed for the slopes. But the metaxy is that point of communion between the physical or ordinary consciousness, if you will, of the human aspiration for communion and, according to Plotinus, the emanation that comes from above, which desires and needs this communication. It's not just a whimsy on the part of the spiritual world, it is a need that desires that connection, which is why we're here. So the metaxy, according to Plato, is that place where those two worlds connect. It is through the power of Eros, which is the passion of the desire to connect, the desire to come into contact, into communion with this force, that in fact allows us to experience Satchitananda, to connect that. Now you'll notice in the Plotinus world, there is in corresponding to Satchitananda here, there is this concept of universal mind or the world soul. And I would quote, this is a book that I did 2 years ago on Anaxagoras, who was the first philosopher in Athens. Athens did not have a philosopher prior to 480 BC when Anaxagoras arrived. It was a very, very religious city. One third of the days of the year were devoted to festivals and rituals, and they were not interested in having anyone come in and compete with their priests and with their religious view. So we think of Athens as being the birthplace of philosophy, but it was quite late that happened. Anaxagoras came into town, and he had written a book which Socrates, as a young man, read and was very interested in. And Socrates was about 18 years old when Anaxagoras arrived from the East, where most of the philosophy was coming from. And here's what he said. Other things all contain a part of everything, but mind, nous, N-O-U-S, but mind is infinite and self-ruling and is mixed with no thing, tapanta, things, but is alone by itself. If it were not by itself, but were mixed with everything else, it would have a share of all things if it were mixed with anything, for in everything there is a portion of everything, except for from mine. So he held mine to be something separate and yet part of the creation, part of the world, part of existence. And the notion of a universal mind is has been a part of the esoteric tradition for millennia, going all the way back to Vedanta, in the oral tradition, probably 2,000, 3,000 BC. And there's a name for it called panpsychism. There is an interesting book out called Panpsychism in the West, which if you're interested, you might want to pick up. But it is there is a sense of universal mind. And in this book on Emerson, because Emerson was extremely interested in universal mind, he referred to it as the oversoul, and is part of his essay called The Oversoul and also Spiritual Laws, and I will quote it here in a moment. There is a great deal of interest still in the idea of universal mind, which has come now into the field of the new physics. And since quantum mechanics has entered the world, there is a sense that that there must be some kind of mind or some kind of consciousness that is other than something generated by evolution in the human brain, that must be out there, which we can still, in terms of what Aquinas offers, we can still connect to. And Roger Penrose, who one of the great physicists at Oxford, has said, Penrose was Stephen Hawking's dissertation advisor, and Penrose has said that quantum mechanics teaches us that consciousness must be part of the creation, must be part of the cosmos. It is, in fact, necessary, and that has to do with the way in which we observe the working of particles, that it appears that observation is critical to their existence. And it is through the presence of universal mind, according to a number of physicists, who only talk about this in bars, but it is still, they don't publish. But in any case, it's coming. And I refer you to Amit Goswami, who was part of the What the Bleep group and has written an interesting book in his lecture here at the Open Center. Is that right, Matt?
Yeah.
And he's out in Oregon most of the time, but he is perhaps the only theoretical physicist who has come out strongly in favor of the concept of universal mind in the cosmos.
What was the name again?
Amit Goswami, G-O-S-W-A-M-I, Goswami. And he wrote a book called, in which the word consciousness appears in the title. Now what I'd like to do is to show you two pieces of text and go through them with you. Let's see how this reads. Okay. Turn this before something happens to you. Okay. Go back into yourself and look. Emerson said at one point, ask a man to study himself and he can't think of anything less interesting, which is why it is so hard when the senses are drawn so powerfully into the world. But ask a man to study himself and he can't think of anything less interesting. But nonetheless, go back into yourself and look, and if you do not see yourself beautiful, then just as someone making a statue, which has to be beautiful, cuts away here and polishes there, and makes one part smooth and clears another till he has given his statue a beautiful face, so you must cut away excess and straighten the crooked and clear the dark and make it bright and never stop working on your statue till the divine glory of virtue shines out on you, till you see self-mastery enthroned upon its holy seat. Self-mastery being the goal. And we all know how difficult that is. The mind is very busy. As I like to say, that most of what goes on in our minds all day is absolutely none of our business. And Emerson said at one point, a man is what he thinks about all day. A man is what he thinks about all day. So if you think about money all day, that's who you are. And that's a testimony. You know, a lot of people think of Emerson as sweet, as our national cheerleader, as a critic recently said in the New York Review of Books. There was a moment, I took a seminar with Harold Bloom once, and Harold Bloom told this story, our great national literary critic. And Harold Bloom was at a cocktail party at Yale, and he was speaking to Bart Giamatti, who was then president and later baseball commissioner. He said to Bart Giamatti, you know, I wish people would stop thinking of Emerson as sweet. And Giamatti said, sweet? Emerson is as sweet as barbed wire. Which is something that after 20 years I can attest to, because I have the scars to prove it. So, self-mastery enthroned upon its holy seat. If you have become this and see it, that's important. If you become it and see it, and are at home with yourself in purity, this doesn't mean good behavior, it means something that Emerson said, nothing is at last sacred but the integrity of your own mind. And by integrity, he meant unity, bringing all the disparate functions of mind together so that you can function properly. With no inward mixture of anything else, but holding yourself, nothing but true light, not measured by dimensions or bounded by shape into littleness or expanded to size by unboundedness, but everywhere unmeasured, because greater than all measure and superior to all quantity. When you see that you have become this, then you have become sight. Not light, but sight. You become a seeing, what Emerson called the transparent eyeball, where you see without comment or judgment. You just see. You have already ascended and need no one to show you. Concentrate your gaze and see this, capital T, alone is the eye that sees the great beauty, for one must come to the sight with a seeing power made akin and like to what is seen. No eye ever saw the sun without becoming sun-like, nor can a soul see beauty without becoming beautiful. You must become first all godlike and all beautiful if you intend to see God and beauty. Now, Plato said that beauty and truth are the same thing, and that if you wanted to know the truth, and what you wanted to do was to select some beautiful thing, your choice. Select some beautiful thing and study it, examine it, work with it. And you will eventually discover through your examination of this beautiful thing that, in fact, beauty is universal, that all things that are beautiful have the same quality. And once you discover the universality, you discover the truth. because they're the same. Now, here's what Emerson says that has a relationship to this Plotinus comment. Oops. We distinguish the announcements of the soul, its manifestations of its own nature, by the term revelation. These are always attended by the emotion of the sublime, for this communication is an influx of the divine mind into your mind. You can see where Plotinus is operating. It is an ebb of the individual rivulet before the flowing surges of the sea of love. Every distinct apprehension of this central commandment agitates men with awe and delight. A thrill passes through all men at the reception of new truth, or at the performance of a great action which comes out of the heart of nature. In these communications, the power to see is not separated from the will to do. The power to see and the will to do are together, are one. But the insight proceeds from obedience, and the obedience proceeds from a joyful perception. Every moment when the individual feels himself invaded by it is memorable. By the necessity of our constitution, the way we're built, a certain enthusiasm attends the individual's consciousness of that divine presence. Enthusiasm, as you may know, is a Greek word from the Greek entheos, to be with the God. Entheos, in the God. So enthusiasm originally has that meaning. The character and duration of this enthusiasm varies with the state of the individual, from an ecstasy and trance and prophetic inspiration, which is its rarer appearance, to the faintest glow of virtuous emotion in which form it warms, like our household fires, all the families and associations of men and makes society possible. A certain tendency to insanity has always attended to opening the religious sense in men. We've heard that this morning already. And in fact, when Emerson began writing, most of the socially acceptable elite of Boston said in letters to one another, the guy is insane. He's obviously insane. Now, when he gave his famous Divinity School address to the graduates of the Harvard Divinity School and spoke of this material, Harvard was so offended, the great fathers of the Harvard faculty were so offended that Emerson was not invited back to Harvard for 40 years. And then, of course, when Emerson became leading intellectual in America, Harvard was embarrassed and invited him back and put him on the board of overseers. Right. Crazy though he was. A certain tendency to insanity, right? The trances of Socrates, it was said, for example, that when Socrates would occasionally go down by the river, he would stand on 1 foot for hours, absolutely still, in trance, like a Maasai warrior, I guess, except without the spear. The vision, the union of Plotinus, again, Plotinus known for being bringing all of this together, all of this philosophy together, with the one. The vision of Porphyry, who was Plotinus' student, the conversion of Paul, the road. Where was the road?
Tarsus.
Where?
Damascus.
The road to Damascus, right. We got that. And of course, the Bible doesn't tell it like a revelation, really. It comes as an admonition. Why are you doing this to me? Right, Jesus says. The conversion of Paul, the aurora of Bateman, the convulsions of George Fox and his Quakers, the illumination of Swedenborg are of this kind. What was, in the case of these remarkable persons, a ravishment, has, in innumerable instances in common life, been exhibited in less striking manner. Everywhere the history of religion betrays a tendency to enthusiasm. The rapture of the Moravian and Quietist, the opening of the internal sense of the word in the language of the New Jerusalem Church, the revival of the Calvinist churches, the experiences of the Methodists are varying forms of that shudder of awe and delight with which the individual soul always mingles with the universal soul. So there is that notion or concept of the individual soul mingling, finding that moment in the metaxy, that moment in the gap of communion between the spiritual and manifest worlds. So, I think I have to stop there. I do have this image of Cleopatra's Needle in Central Park. Any of you wish to go and take a look at it? It's a bit of a walk from here, but obviously not very far away. So, unfortunately, I'm not able to spend further time with you because, as my wife has called me to say, in our house up in near New Paltz, the solar panels have arrived and we're about to go off the grid. So I have to. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. So let's take a little mini break now, and then we're going to have our little performance of Barbara Paula and Emerson and Horace Greeley and others.